Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page with myself, Patrick Donoghue. The World Cup is in full swing at the moment. 1990 remains a World Cup that will live long in the memory. And on today's show, I'm delighted I'm going to be joined by Simon Hart, who just wrote the book World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90, determined that changed football. And I'm delighted I shall be joined on the line by Simon. Simon, how are you today?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, Simon. I mentioned earlier when you talk about World Cups for Irish people, 1990, it was a brilliant one. But for you, what was the motivating factor for writing the book?
You've just said it was a brilliant one for Irish people. Of course, I was experiencing that World Cup, on the other side of the water, in Liverpool at the time where I was living, and so I was, I've always been mindful of the impact it had, in England on English football, Gascoigne's tears, England reaching the semi-finals and so on. And I wanted to just, look at what it meant, around the world, because I was keen to explore, what did it mean in Cameroon, who were the great, romantic favourites of that World Cup, carrying the banner for Africa all the way to the quarterfinals. What did it mean in Italy? What did it mean in Eastern Europe, where, several of the countries are playing in the World Cup for the last time? So that was the idea. We know now, nearly 30 years on, what it meant in England, but what did it mean, elsewhere around the world, and what was the legacy that it left?
Well, there's loads in the book, and I'll ask you about maybe Romania and Eastern Europe is very interesting, but I thought the Irish stuff was very interesting. And one of the bits I found very interesting, Simon, you were talking to one of the players, and one of the players was saying basically, if we had to got over Italy, Jack Charlton really believed there was a chance we would have been playing Argentina in the semi-final. There was a real chance that we could have done something serious in that tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Paddy Bonner who made that point to me, that they did fancy the chances against Argentina. They were just a very hard Irish team to play against. I spoke to Bergamy, who was Italy's captain, about that game, and I don't think anybody wanted to play Ireland, and I don't think anybody was used to that kind of challenge that Ireland, posed at that time. One of the Romanian players had a chuckle about, just playing against Niall Quinn and having to, try and win balls against somebody who was, 6'4". That's why Ireland, feared no death. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think one stat in the book was that when they lost to Italy in, that quarterfinal, it was the first game they'd lost since late 1988 or something. So, they were such a force at the time. They had so many talented players. I know the style of play generated some debate, which is something that I discovered, more as I looked into it for the book. What a roster of players they had, and just what a challenge they gave teams. Mind you, we should add that, I think England players will say the same thing, that they fancied themselves against Argentina too, they got through their semi-final. That's football, I suppose, it's and maybes.
Yeah, exactly. Every team is that. But and you'd mentioned England. Of course, it was an amazing tournament for them. But prior to reading the book, I didn't realise the amount of negative media coverage was being focused on Bobby Robson. Like, some of the headlines prior to the World Cup, it was really incredible stuff.
Yeah, he'd already got, a lot of abuse after the Euro in 88, which, of course, is, a great memory for Irish soccer. But, England lost every game over in West Germany in that tournament, and the English fans disgraced themselves. So there was an awful lot of negativity going into Italia 90, and much of it was centred on Bobby Robson, which would surprise younger people, I suppose, who, just now think of Sir Bobby Robson, this much-loved figure. He'd signed a contract to work for PSV Eindhoven just before the tournament because the FA wouldn't give him you know, a new contract himself, which seems pretty reasonable, you know, looking back. Yeah. But the papers absolutely destroyed him for it. Mm. And in fact, even after the opening game, you know, the 1-1 draw with Ireland over in Cagliari, mm. One of our tabloid papers, The Sun, they had this ridiculous editorial, you know, beseeching Margaret Thatcher, Mrs. T, to bring our boys home to spare us any further embarrassment. Mm.
Yeah.
So you know, that was the climate of the time with our some elements of our press, which is, you know, pretty they changed their tune pretty quickly, you know, mm. 2 weeks later.
Yeah, and it turned out it was a great World Cup, and one of the central characters in that World Cup was Paul Gascoigne, and in the book you have some great stories about him, and I kind of pity Chris Waddle was his roommate over there, and Gascoigne just strikes me as just being an excited child, and it's just amazing that he just approached games like very in a very relaxed nature. He was just a unique character, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, very much so, and one person I spoke to from the England camp at the time, Brian Robson, who he had to actually leave the World Cup early after, or partly because of an incident where they'd had a few drinks one evening, and he was trying to. Brian Robson went back to the room that Gascoigne and Waddle were sharing, and he tried to tip Gazza off the bed and you know, dropped the bed onto his foot. You know, took the toenail off his big toe. You know, imagine if that happened today with you know, Harry Kane, the absolute uproar there'd be. But you know, Gazza, I think for Gazza, it was like it was just a month away with his mates, really. Mm. Which you know, this is somebody who, as we know, had so many problems off the football pitch, but for him, it was his safe haven. And I think the point that Brian Robson made to me was that the England players benefited from having him around, because it was, I guess, it was like having a puppy. Mm. And there's always something to distract you, or something to play with.
Yeah.
And Gazza was that puppy off the pitch anyway.
Mm.
And, you know, on it, because he wasn't a great thinker. He was a player of such instinct that you know, he didn't worry about playing against Mateus or other players. He just went out and did his thing. And I'm sure that rubbed off on the other players around him.
Yeah. And one thing that struck me in the book was there was a sense of fun, just accounts from the Irish camp and the English camp. And there was a great, like, Ireland prior to the Italy game, Jack Charlton was encouraging them to have a few Guinnesses before the game. So it seems that it's something that has been lost at the moment. Like, you wouldn't have that approach in this professional era.
No, or if you did, I think your sports scientist would be having palpitations.
Yeah, yeah. It has changed a lot.
But I mean, they did have fun. I mean, I spoke to somebody in the England setup before they went off to you know, to Russia, and he was saying that Gareth Southgate is, you know, very, very mindful of this, because he of course grew up still in that era. You know, at Euro 96, the England players, I think, had a few interesting evenings, and Gazza was still around then. So, I mean, Southgate's seen that, and he's aware of, you know, the benefits, the bonding benefits of that. But, you know, clearly it doesn't go on the scale that we've, you know, took place in Italia 90. I mean, I think Tony Cascarino said to me that Kevin Sheedy would have turned up at the, you know, Irish international kind of getaways on a Zimmer frame, because he enjoyed it so much.
Yeah.
You know, even if he was injured, he'd have gone along just for the drinking and the good times they had. So, but I mean, of course, that does help on the pitch when you have that tightness and togetherness. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose the way football is today, certain things are being lost, other things are being gained, and maybe there's a little bit less fun nowadays.
And Gascoigne was such a hero, but you really, really capture the relationship between Bobby Robson and Gascoigne very well. And I just want to ask you have a lovely bit in the book where you're talking about, I think it was Bobby Robson, just a few days before he died, and there was an exhibition match between our England and Germany, and Bobby still had that concern because Gascoigne was playing. He was asking one of his sons, I think it was, how did Gascoigne play? So it had that lovely relationship.
I mean, I went to see Sir Bobby's widow, Lady Elsie, and two of her sons down in London. And yeah, he told me that it was Mark Robson, one of the sons, told me this lovely story that you just mentioned about the testimonial match shortly before he passed away, where he couldn't see at that point because of his cancer. He was failing, and he said he turned to his son in the stand at St James's Park, and the first thing he said was, "Is Gazza playing?" Because they. I mean, it was Bob Robson's expression was daft as a brush, which the press sort of took and ran with considerably, because Gazza was this one-off, and Bob Robson had his quirks as well. He'd make players laugh with the daft things he said, and he was this avuncular figure who really got the best out of. After Gazza, I mean, not immediately. I mean, it is interesting how it was only a couple of months before the World Cup itself that Gazza made that place in the team his own. He wasn't, by no means, he wasn't a guaranteed starter until a month or two beforehand. But Bobby Robson, I suppose, just realised what he had, this player he had in his hands, and managed to get the best out of him when it mattered. And I think for Gascoigne, only two managers probably did that. One being, well, maybe three, Bobby Robson, Terry Venables at Tottenham and later with England, and maybe Walter Smith of Rangers. But no, Bobby Robson was the first. And, I was once fortunate enough to see, when I was working at Euro 2004 in Portugal, the hotel I was staying in with work, Bobby Robson was actually working for ITV at the time, and Gazza was there one night, and the following morning at breakfast, they were sat there on a table close to me, just having their breakfast. And even then, Gazza was kind of leaning back on his chair, and you thought he was going to fall over any minute. Yeah. But I'm sure Bobby Robson, playing that father figure role, was saying, "Gazza, stop leaning back on your chair," because you can just imagine that never ended, that paternal kind of care for him.
Yeah, and Simon, it's a fascinating read, and you travelled all corners of the world in the course of your research. I found the stuff about Eastern Europe and Russia fascinating, and it's very interesting reading. In the late 80s, early 90s, East European teams and Russian teams were doing so well in Europe, but after the decline in communism, it just seemed to fall off. And a lot of the people that you spoke to, there seemed to be a lot of nostalgia for the communism era, which is kind of very interesting, I found.
Yeah, I mean, there's a very real sense of something lost. The Romanians I found fascinating. Of course, they played a significant part in the Irish story with the Fall Guys and that famous game in Genoa. And for that group of players, they all, the communist dictatorship of Ceausescu had crumbled just 5 or 6 months previously. The country was in complete turmoil, and they spent that World Cup basically in their hotel rooms speaking to Western clubs and arranging contracts. Without agents, often it would literally be just themselves and the club president in the room. So that they were saying, we weren't actually that focused for the Ireland game. So financially, they benefited hugely. But when they look back, they realised that the system that actually made them as players, this I suppose it was one of the pluses of the oppressive communist world they grew up in, was that there was state-funded sport. Everybody. And there were sports schools and football schools, and they grew up in that. And they nothing's come and replaced us since communism went. So and that you could hear similar things. I went to Moscow and spoke to some of the players from pre-90s, the USSR team. The USSR, I think that entering Italian 90, they were actually they would level with Spain in the all-time World Cup table. But they were major players. Czechoslovakia had been to two World Cup finals, before 1990, which is more than England have managed. Yugoslavia, that incredibly talented group of players. I saw Darko Pančev in Macedonia. He scored the European Cup final winning goal for Red Star Belgrade in 1991. And he was convinced that if that group had stayed together, rather than, of course, disintegrating into what became Serbia, Croatia, and so on, that they possibly won a European Championship or a World Cup. Mm. So, yeah, so many, I guess, slightly wistful tales from that group, from those players from the Eastern Bloc, which I found, you know, fascinating to explore.
No, I did, you mentioned Yugoslavia. I found that all fascinating because a couple of years afterwards you had the war over there. So it really, like, it is remarkable. And it just struck me when reading the book was that so many countries competed at that World Cup for the last time.
Yes, of course, the last time for Soviet Union, as I mentioned, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, you know, in its entirety as that kind of federation of states. Also West Germany, of course, you know, 'cause the Berlin Wall had come down the previous November, and I think German reunification took place in October 1990. So it was the last time for them too. So even when I remember, I got hold of through FIFA's museum or archives, the DVD of the World Cup draw from Natalia 90, and just seeing the, you know, just behind Sepp Blatter as he does the draw, you've got the names of these countries which no longer exist. So that's why it was. I think that's why the book serves a purpose, because, you know, it was a time of change with football and with geopolitically as well, which made it so fascinating. And even I was in Russia last week for the World Cup, and, you know, speaking to some, you know, I was in Volgograd and speaking to Russian people. They are proud, really, of what their country meant, or with the power it had during Stalin's time. I didn't hear anyone complain about Stalin's the paranoia, the brutality, the so many people killed in his regime. They were talking about a strong leader and the good things they had during that communist time. And in a footballing sense, certainly you can understand it from a sporting perspective, if not politically, and, you know, in terms of human rights and freedom and so on.
And another continent you visited was Africa, and one of the stars of that World Cup was Roger Miller. I think he came out of retirement, and you spoke to him in the course of your research for this book.
Probably one of the most surreal afternoons of my life was really the one I ended up sitting in Roger Miller's house, which something I never thought would happen. He's now a sort of honorary ambassador for Cameroon, and lives in a sort of government villa in Yaoundé, the capital. But I mean, just to sit with him and to hear that story again was fabulous. You know, I think it's one of the great World Cup tales. The fact you know, you had this 38-year-old footballer who'd effectively gone into semi-retirement. He was just playing semi-pro football in Reunion, an island off, you know, the east coast of Africa. Because he told me he was sick and tired of the cold in France, because he played for Montpellier over in France, got fed up, just wanted a bit of warm weather to put his feet up. But anyhow, he made the mistake, obviously not a mistake, but he went to play a testimonial game back in Cameroon in the just before Christmas 1989, and people watching that game saw him score a couple of goals and thought, you know, actually Roger Miller's still pretty good. And the president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, basically told the national coach Miller's got to go to the World Cup. Some of the younger players weren't that happy with this, because, you know, they'd actually done the hard bit and got them to Italy, but he was just, you know, he played this role of a super sub. Came on and scored twice against Romania in the group stage, and then came on again and scored twice against Colombia in the round of 16. And, you know, did that famous dance by the corner flag. And of course, this was a time when we didn't have, you know, African players really in English football. So just to see a player do a dance was something, you know, new and funny for us. I suppose the World Cup then had a little bit more of a novelty for us. We weren't saturated with football. We weren't saturated with foreign players, you know, in the English top flight. So just to see a 38-year-old bloke score a goal, dance, you know, it was really something quite spectacular.
Yeah. And the book touches on the changes in football, and it's interesting looking back to that time, but that World Cup would have been considered quite... for Irish people, we loved it, but for some, as a spectacle, there wasn't an awful lot of goals, there was a lot of fouls, so that kind of prompted some rule changes on the back of that World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, I was watching the this absolutely magnificent France-Argentina game yesterday, 7 goals.
Yeah,
and it did get me thinking, you know, we owe Italia 90 you know, the legacy it made with changing the game for the kind of spectacle we got yesterday. Because, I mean, two or three after Italia 90 finished, you know, the Gazzetta dello Sport, the Italian football daily, their headline was World Cup betrayed, because it was the lowest scoring World Cup. It was seen as a very negative tournament. Okay, it was a tournament which had really strong, you know, narratives, big plot lines, but in terms of the football... you know, there was an awful lot of what we would consider today negative football. The back pass rule was still in place. I spoke to Nkono, the Cameroon goalkeeper, when they played Argentina in the opening game. I rewatched the game, and I think there were 13 back passes to him in the first half alone.
Yeah,
just because they, you know, they wanted to slow the game down. Today, we just. It would be. I think if you took a 15-year-old boy and made him watch that game, he'd think he'd be watching another game. And you know, within two years of the World Cup finishing, the back pass law was introduced as a direct consequence of this. I went to see Sepp Blatter in Zurich, and he spoke about the efforts he made in the wake of Italia 90 to change things. And for all of his, you know, obvious, you know, well documented peccadilloes. One thing Blatter did do was to try and, you know, to shift the balance towards offensive football again post Italia 90. Not just in terms of the back pass, but, you know, a red card for professional fouls. He wanted to protect the playmakers. You know, poor old Maradona, a stat that I managed to dig up for the book was he was fouled 58 times,
wow.
sorry, 53 times in Italia 90. Whereas, you know, if we come forward to the World Cup in Brazil 4 years ago, Messi was fouled just 18 times. Just to give you an illustration of the kind of, you know, the rough stuff that somebody like Maradona had to deal with by comparison with, you know, the talented players today.
And before I let you go, Simon, I just want to ask you, it's one thing that I'm just wondering, the expansion of the World Cup in the next, I don't know whether it's the next World Cup, it's been expanded to 48 teams. How do you think that is going to change? Is it like, is that going to be mean we're going to have a lot of poor games? Is that going to diminish the competition?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the World Cup has always been evolving. And I suppose football's always been evolving. I was at the Euro in France 2 years ago. And it wasn't a good tournament. You know, UEFA's technical report afterwards, you know, said quite clearly that there was quite a lot of, you know, narrow, tight group games, teams playing for draws because some of the third-place teams could qualify. So that change, I don't think, created positive football. So I don't know how it will work. From what I've seen, if it's a 48 World Cup, there'll be three team groups, which maybe could mean that some of the last. I really don't.
Yeah.
I've not sat down and thought about
it.
I would be a bit wary. I mean, it seems like the big footballing governing bodies, they like the idea of these football tournaments becoming almost fan festivals. You know, because I was in Russia and, you know, I was out in Moscow a few nights ago, and you know, there were people from so many different countries around, just, you know, having a good time, having drinks. Whether they're, I don't know whether that these are people are huge football fans in itself, or whether they just turn up for the, you know, for the drink and for the fun of it. But the sponsors, I suppose, and the big corporations probably like the idea of these huge festivals of football. But whether it's good for the teams, I'm not so sure. I mean, the World Cup, as we're seeing right now, we're seeing a great tournament this year. So do we really want to tinker with that? But I suppose that football governing bodies, what they do is tinker constantly. And sometimes it comes off, as I think, but VAR is possibly a good thing, but in other instances it doesn't work. But we'll see.
Yeah. Listen, Simon, I really appreciate you joining. You've been very generous with your time, and your book is out at the moment, and it's a cracking read for anyone who's interested in football, interested in politics. It's a really, really great read, and it comes highly recommended. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Liz. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Thanks, Simon, for joining us. Thank you.
Bye.
That was Simon Hart, who joined us today to talk about his book, which is out now. It's a cracking read. I have it in front of me. It really, really kept me entertained for the last couple of weeks. It's The World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90, the tournament that changed football.